I'm Kavitach Boye, and as usual, we have a jam-packed program for you this week. Stay tuned for Reality Check's weekly review for week ending Friday, June 24th. Spring, Tunisia and Egypt turned into a revolution, but none has been quite like the one in Yemen and its President Ali Abdullah Saleh. You may remember the U.S.-backed GCC deal led by Saudi Arabia, a to-sign-or-not-to-sign soap opera by Saleh, in which after months he ended up not signing the deal at all.
Now, there are conflicting reports about his fate. This past Friday, a top Saudi official said Saleh, who's in Saudi Arabia for treatment, will not return to Yemen. His future home not decided, as he put it. This is why Yemeni government officials said Saleh is going to return within days. Now, it's been over 5 days since that announcement. Still, no sign of Saleh. And if he did return, Yemen's influential tribal leader, Sadiq al-Ahmar, warned that his return to the country could spark a civil war.
The revolution in Bahrain had its share of anti-regime demos this past week. The suppression continued unabated, which also included the trial of some opposition leaders. But Bahrain, chairing a meeting of United Nations Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization, Bahrain, whose Saudi-backed forces have been responsible for the destruction of mosques, to chair a UNESCO meeting?
There is a program being organized, and it's to do with the heritage, preservation of heritage. And not only Bahrain is part of the committee, but is actually chairing it. And one of the royal families is coming to France to chair a committee that deals with protection of heritage at the same time that they have been destroying their own heritage, you know, systematically, not only in the last few months, but indeed over the last 50 years, which has escalated in the last few months. You know, mosques have been destroyed, graveyards have been destroyed, places of culture and interest have been destroyed. We also saw how the square symbol of Bahrain was destroyed. So really no regard for cultural heritage, and then, you know, being chairing such a thing. It's actually very distasteful.
Or how about a Bahraini court that handed life sentences to 8 senior opposition leaders?
Hassan Ali Mushaima, Abdul Jalil Al Singis, Abdul Hadi Al Khawaja, Abdul Wahab Hussein Ali, Abdul Jalil Al Mighdad, Saeed Mirza Al Nuri, Muhammad Habib al-Saffaf and Saeed al-Shahabi, who has been tried in absentia, are 8 of the defendants who have received life sentences.
Who beat one of the defendants inside the courtroom.
Reports say during the court session, human rights activist Abdul Hadi al-Khawaja and other defendants were beaten and taken out of the courtroom when they voiced their anger at the ruling. Following the announcement of the special court's ruling, protesters took to the streets to show their outrage. However, they were attacked by the Saudi-backed regime forces.
Here's a fact for you. There was $112 million in sales that increased between 2009 and 2010 by U.S. weapon manufacturers, which has included live ammunition and tear gas, the same ones used today against protesters that you just saw in that clip. Interestingly, there was an official of Human Rights First, Brian Dooley, who was present in the courtroom.
This was not a fair or proper legal process by any standard. There was evidence of torture, denial of proper contact with lawyers, and failure to provide basic legal safeguards. This was a sham trial, another stain on Bahrain's already discredited human rights record.
When you are summarily rounded up in the middle of the night by armed thugs, you are disappeared to some jail or prison, who knows where, because your family is not notified where you're taken to, and then you're beaten into submission, and then told weeks later you'll be put on trial the next morning, and you go there and you were found guilty, and sentenced either to life imprisonment or several multi-year sentences, then this is what we call a farce.
Which puts into question whether that is a farce based on this guest's description on Press TV News Analysis, or a court which calls itself the Court of National Safety. This past week, the International Monetary Fund, IMF, gave a warning that the recovering global economy is at risk, with U.S.'s budget deficit and Greece's debt crisis to be major concerns. IMF Chief Economist Olivier Blanchard.
Many countries, including the United States, are yet to put in place a convincing medium-term fiscal consolidation plan. Such a lack of adjustment leads markets to worry. Worries lead to higher risk premia, increasing the cost of borrowing not only for the sovereigns, but also for private borrowers.
The European banks are already very thinly capitalized as a result of the crisis that took shape in 2008. And if anything, they're trying to raise their minimum capital requirements. So if they want them to voluntarily restructure these bond portfolios, that's going in the opposite direction, which means that they would be in violation of certain capital requirements that they're trying to address to take care of the bigger global banking and economic crisis. So there's that's one side of the problem, as has been described. And of course, the other side of the problem is that if there is an outright default, it's a credit event. And interestingly enough, the biggest losers in that could be American banks, because the American banks have written the credit default swaps on these bonds that are held by European banks.
Good time to bring in Yvonne Ridley and her program, The Agenda, here, since she asked the question.
The financial world is in turmoil, America can't climb out of its recession, and most of Europe is in the grip of austerity. So isn't it time the IMF and the World Bank broke with tradition? Why give the top jobs to financial gurus from the US and Europe? Traditionally, a European runs the IMF and an American heads the World Bank. But critics say the world economy is in such dire straits that such cozy, outdated traditions should be set aside in favor of candidates from emerging economies.
By now, many of you are aware that the financial meltdown was due to the mortgage crisis in the U.S., which began unfolding somewhere between the years 2007 and 2008. But I bet you'll be shocked by the next clip taken from the documentary Plunder, the Crime of Our Time, on the amount that was involved in the crisis.
The money was made because several layers up a pyramid, Wall Street investment firms and commercial bank investment groups decided to repackage those mortgages, create layers of them that they then resold to investors.
Here's what happens. There are three defaults on mortgages. The bank that holds those sells those at 10 cents on the dollar to a second bank. That bank puts those together with three other defaults and three other defaults and makes a second package and sells it to a third bank. The third bank sells six of these things, packages, and bundles them and sells them to some investor who has no idea what he has.
They borrowed against those layers, which is the real crime. They would take a little piece of a layer of a security underneath which somewhere there was a bunch of home buyers, and they would take it and they would borrow 30 times the amount of money that it represented.
Five big investment banks dominated Wall Street. It is they who took the subprime loans purchased from banks and packaged them as bundled investments to be sold worldwide.
We're talking trillions of dollars, $14 trillion worth of asset backs with subprime and other types of mortgages and CDOs created between 2003 and 2007. $14 trillion were created on that. Investment houses and hedge funds and private equity funds could leverage 30, 40 times. Banks could leverage 15 to 20 times. On average, they could only leverage 13 times, but on certain securities.
But that's more than the value of the whole country, of the whole gross domestic product.
If you, on average, and this is a very conservative estimate, assume that the average leverage for the $14 trillion worth of asset backs and CDOs was 10 times, which to me is a conservative estimate, that's $140 trillion worth of nothing. If you lose the $14 trillion, the other $140 minus the $14 trillion doesn't exist. You have nothing. You have no collateral left to pay to the people that you borrowed money from, and it all falls down.
And what about Obama's promises? He instilled hopes, but has he delivered?
moment I take office, my top priority will be to do everything I can to make sure your tax dollars are protected.
So you can understand the outrage when word first broke that AIG was paying out some big bonuses to some of their employees.
I want to use a scalpel so that people who need help are getting help. Absolutely, we need earmark reform, and when I'm president, I will go line by line to make sure that we are not spending money unwisely.
As he signed a bill stuffed with pork barrel spending.
Behind closed doors, it was, critics say, business as usual. 1,100 pages loaded with about 8,500 pet projects known as earmarks.
The key is making sure that the next Treasury Secretary understands that it's not enough just to help those at the top.
It's clear he knew and approved of bonuses that the White House now thoroughly condemns.
I have complete confidence in Tim Geithner. It's time to return to fiscal responsibility and pay-as-you-go budgeting.
The president's budget will leave a whopping $9.3 trillion deficit, far larger than administration estimates.
Well short of some of the things he said during the campaign.
For quite some time, Libyan officials have been saying that since the NATO airstrikes began, civilians are being killed. Over 800 is what they have said so far. At first, this was dismissed by the world as lies by the Libyan government. But an incident last week is beginning to tell another story.
Basically, this is another night of murder and terror and horror in Tripoli caused by NATO. You have seen with your own eyes the terrible disaster that is taking place every day in Tripoli. Five families living in five houses together in one compound in a civilian neighborhood of Souq al-Jumaa in Tripoli were attacked with rockets and bombs.
Yet again, we are seeing what the US and Europe shamefully call collateral damage in the form of human lives, like we have seen previously in Iraq and Afghanistan and in many other parts of the world. And really, this apology by NATO, it's an absolute joke. It's the first apology that we've had in 3 months, despite the fact that civilians have been dying at the hands of NATO airstrikes every day in the past 3 months. There have been thousands of strikes on the country. So they made the apology yesterday on Sunday. And then again today at 2 o'clock in the morning, there was yet another attack on the city of Sorman, just 130 kilometers west of Tripoli, where a further 15 civilians were killed and a further three children were killed.
In terms of the sorties, 13,000 and then 4,000 airstrikes. Well, common sense dictates that if you drop an ordnance in the middle of a crowded residential area, there are going to be civilian casualties.
It's the whole NATO effort is running into some very serious problems. It is killing innocent people, and it's my understanding that that they were keeping an eye on the facility for at least a few days before they actually bombed it, and knowing that there were that it was a family compound and that there were women and children at the compound. So there's absolutely no excuse for what had occurred, and indeed the whole NATO effort now seems to be hitting more and more civilians.
In news from Syria, President Bashar al-Assad confirmed that his country is determined to go ahead with reforms, in which, after his speech, millions poured onto the streets to show their support of him.
National dialogue is the title of the current stage. The dialogue committee will invite more than 100 figures that represent all spectrums to consult with them about the standards and the mechanisms of dialogue.
The U.S. again threatened the Syrian government with regime change.
There needs to be actual action towards political dialogue so that this transition to a more democratic Syria can take place. And as we have said in the past, President Assad needs to either lead that transition or get out of the way.
Syria's foreign minister, meanwhile, Mawlid al-Mualim, lashed out at the EU for new sanctions that he described as a declaration of war targeting ordinary Syrians.
Now they are targeting the daily life of the ordinary people in Syria, and this is equivalent to the war against Syria. And I am, as a foreign minister, I'm telling you that frankly, as I told you in 2006 in the parliament, we will forget that Europe is existing on the map.
Turkey this past week said the Syrian president's speech on reform was not enough. The Turkish president, Abdullah Gül, said Assad should transform Syria into a multi-party system. Turkey's role in NATO vis-a-vis Syria was the subject of Jody Sobral's report.
Turkey has approved plans to expand a NATO airbase accommodating an estimated 400 operational and technical forces. The move comes amid ongoing unrest in neighbouring Syria. NATO's Secretary General says restructuring facilities will make NATO leaner, more flexible, and better able to deal with future challenges. Local observers, however, say that it could have a different purpose.
The base will not be anymore as an only Air Force base, and they're turning it into a land base, which, considering the region's importance in the operations against Libya, could be seen as the main point of entry for NATO.
Others agree that Turkey is a strategic launch pad for NATO operations, but that it's too early to tell whether Syria is being discussed in these terms.
At the moment, there's no NATO decision to be engaged in Syria, so the two issues should be kept apart, and Turkey has an interest in peaceful change, bringing about peaceful change in Syria.
Turkey has the second largest military in the NATO alliance after the US, a reason observers say it is of strategic importance within the scope of NATO's regional approach. Jody Sobral, Press TV, Istanbul.
Turning our attention to the United Nations, has the UN done enough for Palestinians living under the Israeli siege on Gaza? After 5 years, why is there a siege which is claiming innocent Palestinian lives?
The UN has this week announced how far Gaza's stifled economy has taken a toll on people trying to survive in the Strip.
The UN Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees in the Near East, UNRWA, says in a new report that broad unemployment in Gaza in the second half of 2010 reached an unprecedented 45.2%.
The report also shows that wages are in decline, and the worst hit by this crisis were the 1.5 million refugees as well as the private sector.
Aid is required.
Mr. Nasserki went on to say there clearly is a need for aid to be taken to Gaza, but questioned how this should be done.
Is that there are established channels for such aid to be delivered, and at this stage it would seem to be preferable for it to be delivered in that way, rather than to risk further tensions in the kind that we saw a year ago.
For that matter, what about the Arab Spring? What about human rights in countries like Bahrain and Yemen? Why is there no UN action there? Do you think the UN track record deserved the following praise?
On behalf of the Secretary General, the majority of the UN General Assembly believes that the UN Human Rights Council is a good thing. It's undergone review, and the results of that review were made official on Friday by the General Assembly.
The technical nature of the improvements underlines that a great majority of member states perceives the Human Rights Council as a strong and largely well-functioning organ, and that a major institutional overhaul was neither required nor desirable at this stage.
And for that matter, did Secretary General Ban Ki-moon deserve to be re-elected?
With the interest of the United Nations only in view,
and not to seek,
and not to seek,
or accept instructions,
or accept instructions,
In regard to the performance of my duties,
in regard to the performance of my duties,
from
any government
or other authority external to the organization,
or other authorities external to the organization.
Thank you.
Well, with all due respect to the good people within the UN is at the heart of this problem. The UN partition plan basically stole over half of the land of Palestine and gave it to people who didn't even come from that land. So from the very beginning, the UN has not been helpful to the Palestinian cause. The idea that they are accepted channels and that this is somehow sufficient to satisfy the needs of the Palestinian people is an insult to all of us who've spent time there. The fact is that Israel continues to maintain effective control over air, land, sea, and space, and the Palestinian people in Gaza have, in fact, been put on a diet.
Well, you be the judge on the UN. Well, time now to take a look at Britain's case against Press TV.
From the bloody streets of Tehran to a media controversy in Britain.
They wave information in front of them and say, can you write a story along these lines?
Attacks on Press TV are orchestrated by the American embassy. That's clear from the leaks in WikiLeaks.
گفتن که رویه قضایی هم 6 سال شاید طول بکشه بعد از این 6 سال شاید معذرت خواهیت بکنیم از شما و شما رو بفرستیم بیرون یا اینکه اعدام میشید و گفتن به احتمال زیاد هم اعدام میشید.
So for somebody who was so afraid of being executed while he was there and had gone through such an ordeal, why did it take him 2 whole months for him to make his complaint?
But I'm in no doubt at all that this story is a pretext for closing us down.
On December the 27th, 2008, the world looked on in horror as Israel launched an invasion of the Gaza Strip, and Press TV was quite literally at the forefront of reporting events. It was after the 22-day war on Gaza that Press TV began to quickly gain prominence and saw a rapid rise in viewer figures. And it was also at this point that the attempts to silence the channel commenced, as the complaints to Ofcom began to flood in.
Certainly in MI6 they have a section called Information Operations, which has a sort of grouping of tame journalists, of pet journalists, who are favoured out on the national media. And they will wave information in front of them and say, can you perhaps just write a story along these lines? And then the story goes into print and then it becomes a fact because it's been printed in the national newspaper. So you build up a sort of paper trail.
The CIA setting up fake websites under the cover of job-finding centres in which U.S. agents look for ways to recruit Iranians to their cause. One example, how the U.S. tries to recruit spies, covered in the program Iran Today.
In a statement, Iran's intelligence ministry announced that the CIA had set up fake websites. Under the cover of job-finding centers, U.S. agents looked for ways to recruit Iranians to their cause. Now, Tehran says it's ready to name names.
Holbertson Advisors. Technical Hiring. Engineer One Incorporated, Dayon Capital, Nuevara International, Waldmiller Group, Marketing Research Association. These are the websites that Tehran says were used as a cover by CIA agents to find the right connections inside Iran by representing themselves as a legitimate company.
U.S. agents used these identities to contact Iranian citizens whom they had targeted for covert operations.
That is a must-see program. Time now for PressTV.ir. The entry America heading in a dangerous direction caught our attention on PressTV.ir's U.S. desk. It said the United States is heading in a dangerous direction as some insist that the U.S. should be seen as a nation on top of the world. This according to Robert Jensen, an Austin-based professor of journalism and board member of the Third Coast Activist Resource Center.
Now, in an interview with Press TV's U.S. desk, he expressed hope that the American people would force the government to pursue a more peaceful and progressive path in interactions with the rest of the world. He said the economic and military power of the United States is fading, and that America needs now to change its dominance-seeking attitude.
Another edition of Reality Check has drawn to a close. Please send us any comments or suggestions to realitycheck@presstv.ir. And for the ending, a Barack Obama impersonator was ushered off the stage at a GOP forum after he mocked Republican presidential hopefuls and President Barack Obama himself. Maybe after his appearance, the organizers figured he just looked and acted too much like the U.S. president. See you next week.
I love vacations. A few months back, the family and I took a nice relaxing vacation in the state of my birth, Hawaii, or as the Tea Partiers still call it, Kenya. My favorite month is February, Black History Month. You see, Michelle, she celebrates the full month, and, you know, I celebrate half.
Gotta go. God bless you. God bless the United States. God bless America. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.